Okay. Oh, your sound just got really weird. Say something.
Hello. Does that sound strange?
That's just Skype doing something to it, but yeah, it went like a kind of effect on a techno song. He went like all growly for a second, like, ooh.
Like I was being auto-tuned?
Wouldn't say auto-tune, but yeah, just like you're like kind of one of the background shouts in a 90s techno song. It was weird. But anyway, hello, welcome to Film Interrupted. My name's Jack.
My name is Martin.
My name's Nick.
This week, on our Christmas episode, we'll be discussing different adaptations of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. This was Nick's pitch. I thought we kind of caned to death the Christmas movies, and I really, really didn't want to talk about Jingle All the Way again. So,
did I actually say that we were going to talk about Jingle All the Way?
We would have talked about Jingle All the Way. We are talking about Jingle All the Way now, so yeah, we would have.
I would have made some effort to squeeze it, and I just can't remember that I actually had gone that far.
Yeah, I mean, on this one, I'm busy. I just went with the flow on it. I was like, okay, you want to do Christmas Carol stuff? Okay.
This is the worst thing.
I honestly wasn't, you know, enthused, but I couldn't be arsed trying to come up with my own topic. I was cool doing various Christmas stuff. The Christmas Carol, just like, fine, okay.
I feel like I'll be doing the heavy lifting in terms of the Christmas cheer this episode, I think. As two new parents, maybe it wasn't the best time to start getting all Santa-ish, but, you know.
Well, I mean, just in terms of like the Christmas stuff, I felt like I'd said we covered something like 7 or 8 films last Christmas, and just talking about our favourite Christmas films, and I didn't know what more there was to be said. I mean, I still haven't seen A Christmas Story. I bought it on DVD recently. I'm going to sit in and watch it sometime this week. But everything else I wanted to talk about, we had talked about, so I just tried to take it somewhere that was, you know, thematic and appropriate. And for what it's worth, I did, you know, let's start talking about the films. I have no idea what the first version, who was directed by, who starred in it. Can someone give me a bone here? What was the first one we talked about again? The earliest one?
The earliest one was Scrooge with Alistair Sim. That was the earliest one that I watched, but there's tons of these films, so, you know, there's every chance that you have watched an earlier one than that.
And I think the earliest one that I saw was one kicking about on Amazon Video, narrated by Vincent Price. So I think it was about 51 that it was coming from. And as far as the other things that I saw that were related to, I watched An American Christmas Carol with Henry Winkler. And that, I think that was courtesy of like Christmas 24 on.
Man, I love these channels.
A buried cable channel kind of thing.
The seasonal, what is it, every other time of the year? Is it like Movies 24 or something like that? But then when Christmas comes, they just rebrand it. And
yeah, and either that or they only start the 1st of December. And then they fire everyone on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like I could believe that, like, in terms of just a yearly opportunity for film school graduates or something like that, just to get their teeth into the industry.
And back out onto the streets.
Absolutely. I mean, they need to learn that lesson pretty quickly.
Uh-huh. I'm trying to think, what else did I watch? There was Scrooged, saw a Muppet Christmas Carol, which I'd never seen before.
For me, the worst one that I saw was Muppet Christmas Carol, and it's still a film that I really like, so it wasn't as if any of these films was a disaster. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I kind of need you guys now to tell me that you love the story of A Christmas Carol, or else I'm going to start crying, and you don't need that in the cupboard.
I do enjoy the story of A Christmas Carol. I mean, here's the thing. It's omnipresent, even, you know, outside this time of year. If you have a TV show that runs for long enough, you'll have a Christmas Carol themed episode in the same way you will have a It's a Wonderful Life or Wizard of Oz themed episode, you know? It's a really good structure to tell a story, and it's a really good way to develop a character. And yeah, I've got a lot of, I've got a lot of affection for it. I don't think I've got any one favourite film, but I'm definitely with you. It's something I really enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, really good. Every time, I mean, to be fair, I think if there's ever a point where I'm not interested in watching another version of of Christmas Carol, it's right now, because I've just watched 5 or something like that, and the story is, I'm kind of done with it for this year, but I can imagine in years to come, I'll still look forward to revisiting or starting a new, you know, any version of Christmas Carol. I'd even give the Jim Carrey one a go. So, did any of you guys watch the Scrooge, the one with Alistair Sim in it?
I did, no. I did.
You didn't?
No.
I mean,
I think you missed a treat, Martin. I think just aside from the theme of it, just for me, the first thing is like I remember seeing it and like, oh yeah, I love black and white cinematography. And, you know, talking about the future of cinema, the past of cinema, and just something that just looks so immaculate and clean and beautiful. Like this is. I mean, growing up in a certain year in the UK, you got a lot of stuff just rerunning on TV and Channel 4. So black and white cinema was part of my youth in that way. And it just looks so good. Like there was a shot early on in Scrooge and Marley's shop where I think it was his nephew or one of the people who were coming in to ask him for money, where they've got this shot where they just pull a camera back through a door into a wide shot from what was a close, and just knowing the technology they have to deal with at that time to pull stuff like that off. You know, as a cinephile, that's really admirable, but even just stepping back as someone who's not interested in cinema technology of the era, it's just so clean and crisp and everything's so detailed and really beautiful, beautiful looking film, beautiful.
Yeah, and I think Christmas does really well in black and white, like in terms of even especially a film like this with like a sort of melancholy air to it, if you can remove the sort of bright colours of Christmas and invest it in something that, you know, is just isolating whites from blacks and then, you know, shades of grey, then I think it really does add some to the atmosphere of a film like this.
Mm-hmm. I had like a kind of month where all my opportunities to watch films were just kind of like, you know, kept being pulled away by like kids not being well and having to do this and having to do that and having to help out mum and dad because my dad had broke his ankle and that kind of thing. So I didn't have the chance to watch as much. It was like probably like 2 more films down my list,
yeah,
you know, for this topic. And yeah.
Well,
I really, really wish I'd seen it instead.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly sounds it. I would say I really did like the film. You said you really did too, Jack.
Yeah, I mean, there's parts, just any film that old, generally the humour doesn't age well. And I'd say that's true of this too. I mean, the final act with, you know, Ebenezer Scrooge coming to the conclusion of the fact that he's alive and taking joy in life. You know, the scene where he does a handstand and things like that doesn't age well. And it's got the atypical Tiny Tim where you're just like, oh, for God's sakes. God blesses everyone. It's too much sentiment. But I mean, those elements do age badly, and you come to expect that from a film this old. And yeah, it was, other than that, like really well done, really well paced. It's surprisingly hard to pace a story. I'd noticed that much when I was watching different versions of it. But yeah, really well done. I appreciated it. I liked the performance. And just that certain class, you know, of like English stage actor making movies, that era when that still happened, was really cool. It was good to see that. That may just, once again, admit, might just be being very, very nostalgic for the kind of thing that I had access to as a kid through British TV. But, yeah, very high quality actors, very quality performance, cinematography, direction, all strong, just a little dated, but I mean, it's like over 60 years old. What do you expect? You know, it's going to have those notes which don't straight contemporary humour or sentiment, but yeah, really good.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love the performance. I think he just, the way that he says the words, he just kind of spits them out as if he's in complete command of them. It's not as if there's, it doesn't seem like there was even any rehearsal needed. It's like he's speaking them straight from his mind. And he plays this really, really great note throughout the film where he actually seems like he's in pain when he's as mean as he is, where it seems like he's doing as much harm to himself as he is doing to others. And it's like a real masochistic thing when he's horrible to people. And it's a note that I haven't really seen played by anyone else who's touching the character. And it was extremely refreshing and surprising. I think what I had in my mind was more the sort of very unnuanced approach that I saw in The Muppet Christmas Carol. Or actually, I watched Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol as well. And it will surprise you to hear that it's not an especially nuanced look at the character.
Really?
He is just, you know, viciousness. personified. But I think what Alistair Sim does really well is, like I say, just to be able to look as if he's in agony when he's being as mean as he is. And I'm not sure if this is in the original story. Have either of you read the story?
I have not, no.
No? Well, I mean, it probably isn't even worth giving a breakdown of the story because everyone knows it. It's so ubiquitous. It's Ebenezer Scrooge. He's a bastard. He gets visited by the ghost of his ex-partner, who tells him that he's going to be visited by three spirits who are going to take him to the past, present, and future of his life and encourage him to be a better person as a result. But what this film does, it concentrates on the fact that it talks about how his father hated him because when he was born, his mother died. And that links in with, in this story, his nephew who whose mother died during the birth of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it extremely powerful when he eventually comes to his realisation that he should live a better life. And first of all, it's quite a flamboyant realisation that I wasn't really feeling. You know, it's more the sort of traditional heel clicking, like you say, handstanding. But at one point, there's always the scene where he makes up with his nephew, or in Scrooged, the brother, when he goes to the party that they're having on Christmas Day that he's refused an invite to. But in Scrooge, in the Alistair Sim version, he just approaches that party with like a real humility that is so sweet, that it's really quite lovely. I think his performance is so assured and comfortable. And it really, I mean, people talk about it being the performance that all Scrooges are sort of measured against. And I would completely agree. I don't think there really has been a better singular performance of that character, or at least a more interesting performance of that character. But I think I'll talk about Scrooged as well in terms of what I think Bill Murray's doing. And I think he's doing some interesting stuff too. But I mean, I'm trying to think if there's anything else to say about the film. Do you know what I liked? Did you get, Jack, a sort of horror vibe in some parts of the film? Like a real gothic, horror-y aspect?
Not so much. I mean, the general tone of it I thought was a bit uneven, but I thought it carried itself. It didn't really carry itself. A Christmas Carol carried it just in how ubiquitous it was, so you knew the tone and what to expect. So I didn't notice a particular vibe from that. But I did want to talk about the performance of Scrooge you were just talking about, and I'd agree with you, but I thought it was unusual in that of all the films, different versions I've seen, this is the one that put the least attention on Scrooge as a presence in his own past, present, and future. And the story would often just cut away to younger versions of him acting things out, where he was just on the side, and you maybe saw him once every 5 minutes where he was looking in. And I thought that was quite brave, because you normally have to ground him in his own past, where in actual time, you just let the scene play out. You know, they didn't even do like cuts to him watching it for the most part. They only allowed that very occasionally. If you're talking about the gothic horror vibe, just in like the Ghost of Christmas Future, that's always there in every version I see.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking more even the initial visit from
Jacob Marley.
That was comedically over the top, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I liked it, even though it is played for, you know, melodrama. I did really, there's a almost Sam Raimi aspect to it, where like the banging at the door and cameras flying into people's faces and stuff like that. It was very heightened, but I did really, really enjoy it. I think even there's a scene where he visits, it's presumably in the Ghost of Christmas Past section, where he visits the dying Jacob Marley and the Undertaker's at the top of the stairs. And I think there's some good comedy there, with the Undertaker waiting for this guy to die so that he can be the first one to claim the corpse and you know, get presumably he would get some sort of fee for his services. But there's a real horror aspect there. There's almost a sort of Nosferatu vibe at some parts of it. I like those bits quite a bit. I also like the director sometimes does have some like flourishes, some embellishments. There was a weird emphasis on Victorian dolls in one section for about 30 seconds. But I was waiting for them because right at the start of the film it says Victorian dolls supplied by whatever company.
Well, if you want to get some creepy in, then...
And they are creepy as fuck, but they really had no purpose. Tiny Tim's just looking at them through a shop window and, you know, says something like, "Oh, Mama, I wish I could have," you know, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, no real purpose, but I kind of liked it. I like these sort of little flourishes that just add a bit of personality to it, because I think if the film has any flaws at all, it's kind of indebted to the material to quite a... any story is indebted to this kind of material, or any film version, rather. So you end up, you know, spelling out a story rather than, you know, actually building a world and having characters live in it. But no, generally I had a tremendously positive experience with Scrooge, and it was the first one that I saw, and I feel like it was a really good way to kick off, you know, a very classical look at this story.
Mm-hmm.
I had the same experience. It was the first film that I watched, and I was really happy with it. I just wanted to give you like a quick, like, that scene you're talking about with the dolls. My wife was like kind of walking through the room as I was watching, and she's like, "What the hell are you watching? This is creepy." And it's just like, once again, how quickly something dates, where I'm assuming at one point that would have been something desirable and wanted for, but in the present day it's like, what the hell are you collecting in the corner of your room? I used to know a girl that collected things like that in her bedroom in her, like, you know, late 20s, and it never stopped being weird. It's very creepy.
I think they're up there with, like, you know, ventriloquist mannequins.
Yeah,
it's just being a red light.
At this stage, they've just been entirely adopted by the horror film community, so there's no other context that they can be seen in. You know,
I'd be terrified. I'm just imagining like someone giving one of those to like one of my kids for Christmas.
Yeah,
just like, why are you trying to murder my family? This is clearly cursed. I will not have it in my home.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I think it's the aspect of this could have been owned by someone who's dead, and even though I have absolute, like, I have no belief in the supernatural, but I live in fear that the supernatural could be true. And it's a bizarre fear that, you know, I mean, in the films, people never begin believing that the supernatural could exist until there's something disgracefully terrifying at the bottom of their bed. So I feel like I'm that person. But it turns out my whole family believe in ghosts and the supernatural and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So we were out for dinner with them maybe a week or two ago, and we started to talk about how my mum and dad's house is apparently haunted, and it was just spoken about so matter-of-factly that I think I've just been out of that environment so long that it was like, oh yeah, there was a woman, she was wearing, you know, a Victorian night... A Victorian house is built in the fucking 70s. It was Victorian that was living there. Jesus Christ. It's the same like when people say, you know, oh, I saw the ghost of, you know, a man walking down the corridors of this hospital. Oh, I knew he was a ghost. He was in a black suit. Black, I don't know what, so the suit has a ghost as well, apparently. Like, if surely the only thing that would transcend death would be the man.
No, not his fabrics travel as well.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
I didn't realise.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's not time travel.
Incidentally.
You can't take clothes when you time travel. But when you become a ghost,
you can take them with you.
You can choose. You can go back to your wardrobe and, like, you know, be the best version of yourself that you want to be as a ghost.
Do you know?
Because otherwise, you're just stuck wearing, like, you know, pants and a, you know, an old T-shirt with holes in it. You know.
Exactly. Or nude, which is, you know, in nobody's interests. You know, but the one, and I know this is off topic, but it's, I like this. There was a TV. I suppose you'd call it like a mini episode of a TV show or something like that. It's called The Stone Tape. Have you heard of this? It was on the BBC.
No.
You can catch it on YouTube.
You've rated this on Letterboxd really highly.
It's really, really interesting, and it's probably one of the most interesting explanations of like a paranormal investigation or something like that. And what it is like a group of people in this supposedly haunted house, but what they've worked out is that it's actually the stones in the wall that have some kind of ability to record the past and replay it, and it's something to do with the materials in the stone that is actually like a recording device that they're trying to extract and work out exactly what it's doing, but it's replaying the horrors of the past, that whatever happened in this house.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very, very clever indeed. I'd never ever considered anything like that, but yeah, very, very good. But again, we're miles off topic, so I'll try and steer it on and see if there's anything else I've got to say about Scrooge.
Look, maybe we shouldn't do that. I was going to say, which is your favourite of each type of ghost, but let's just talk about it. All right. Did you like Muppet's Christmas Carol? Because you were talking about performances of Scrooge, and that's the year where Michael Caine was just calling it in for about a decade. I mean, that was terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he gives a remarkably nuanced performance. I said before, he plays it very one note. He does the material a service, and there is something to be said for that. Like, there's something that... there's something about him just embracing that aspect of the character that makes it quite satisfying inherently, but I don't think it has the richness that I've seen in some of the other performances. Do you think he's good, Martin?
It didn't feel like it was a stretch for him by any means. I think in pretty much all the versions of this story that I've seen, the beginning of it is really awkward. You know, it takes, you know, that kind of that leap into the imaginary when you start getting the supernatural stuff happening to actually draw much of a performance from the films that I've seen. Up until then, it always felt awkward and stilted. And I mean, it's like four or five different versions that I've watched, and it's all of a similar kind of, you know, pastiche until they actually, you know, start feeling their way into the film.
And somehow the writers always latch on to that reducing the surplus population line. That seems to be in every version consistently.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the first 10 minutes it's just like, you know, when's he going to say humbug?
Yeah.
And then how many times is he going to say humbug? I didn't get a chance to really dissect that film. We were like, all right, we'll get, like, you know, mattress down on the floor, and, you know, we'll get a duvet and like Christmas stuff, and I'll watch it with my son and all that kind of thing. And after 15 minutes, Nathan just started going mental. He just hadn't slept properly in the day, and it just became like this emotional torment for us. I thought Michael Caine did very well at showing the real horror of actually getting to be a spectator in a room when people are just talking about how much they hate you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the real horror in this whole story for me.
I would agree
just
in that.
How dreadful all the rest of the other people are. See, all the shit gets pinned on Scrooge. He's the bad person. Everyone else is just out for themselves as well.
I would completely agree.
You know? And they're just all getting together and talking about how much of a shit this guy is. And Michael Caine's there just watching it happen. And you're just like, oh, poor fucker. You know?
Yeah, see at that party scene with his nephew? That wee bastard is bang out of order. See, when he does the guessing game, he goes, oh, it's Ebenezer Scrooge.
But yeah, I mean, I did really have a lot of sympathy for Michael Caine, you know, in that scenario. I thought he acted the pain of it really successfully, because it's a horrible, horrible thought to have, that you just get to be this powerless observer.
Yeah, and I do sort of lose sympathy for the others when they start slagging off Ebenezer Scrooge. I do like it when, I believe in the Alistair Sim version and Scrooged, it's the brother or nephew who jumps to the defence of Scrooge in both instances, and he has to, you know, can be confronted by the fact that even though he's a shit to this guy still stands up and defends him when everyone else has no interest in him. And it's that, you know, adds to his agony. The fact that he goes to the nephew's house and the nephew's taking the piss out of him is bizarre. I have no idea what they're going for, but it certainly that has no effect on me when I watch it, like, apart from to be appalled at the conduct of this wee shit.
Yeah, no, he's an arsehole.
I think you're being very, very kind to Michael Caine in this. To me, it felt like, you know what? Gotta pay the rent here. Mortgage is due in the third house. Wanna open that new bar on the East End. Gonna take this gig. It's a kids film. You know, kids are stupid. I don't really have to do much in it. And I think you're being very kind to him. Honestly, I think Kermit gave a stronger performance than Michael Caine in this version of A Christmas Carol. But I want to put down a negativity for a while and just say I think that the Muppets are a very good vehicle for this because they do have that sense of joy to them. And even in their weakest films, and they do have some really weak ones. I mean, for every one like starring Ricky Gervais or whoever star, you know, comes out to sing the joys of the Muppets, there are four or five you've never heard of that are complete garbage, but they just got this joy to them where you don't have to like the musical numbers, but it's just really heartfelt. And, you know, Jim Henson had that ability to like imbue these little sock puppets with a lot of life. I think that still lives on.
My mate watched it at the same time as I did, and he was really struck by the Muppets themselves and how like animated they are, how physical they are. You know, they give very, like, even though they may physically be very limited in terms of what the puppet's capable of, just the amount of movement is actually quite staggering when you watch them. Which is why Emma was saying surely there should be a museum where you can go and visit the Muppets. But it's like, can you imagine how depressing it would be to see the Muppets without that, without that kind of movement associated with them? They're so closely linked with their physicality.
No, it'd be like Alien 3 or something. It'd be like horrible twisted versions of Kermit before they got him right, just like suspended in formaldehyde.
Oh, I thought you meant like the Aliens trophy room or something, the Predators trophy room.
No,
it would be a Kermit head.
Yeah. I think like a twisted, like, you know, Kermit, you know, Miss Piggy hybrid, just like, kill me!
Let me just do one. My favourite Muppets in this were the narrator of Gonzo and Rizzo the Rat. I liked the fact that they were like really self-conscious, omnipotent narrators, and they were like kind of referencing the story itself. And honestly, that's what made me feel like Michael Caine was a really patronising reference, is that those could be so like witty, you know, and on the cuffs, and they could draw attention to the fact that it was a story being told, but they didn't, you know, negate the power of what was being told. And then you had Michael Caine, you know, coming out of his trailer once an hour to do a shot. Like, I just couldn't get behind it. His performance, I just felt like if you're being out-acted by a puppet, you are doing something wrong. You know, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you're
but they're like the world's favourite puppets, you know?
So. Maybe so, but he's you know, he's Britain's favourite actor. He's a golden child. But for decades, and I think it was even more than one decade, yeah, for a good while, from a stretch, he was calling it in for a long, long time. A long time. And he's come back into favour now. And I don't think that's unjustified. I think he gave a really high quality set of performances towards the end of the 2000s that justifiably brought him back into the public eye. But I don't know what was going on. It's like, you know, his third quarter life crisis or whatever, but like, he was not doing quality stuff for a while. He wasn't trying, and he's clearly capable of great things. So this is not a slight on him or his abilities, but his attempt at doing something in this movie was very short of capable. But yeah, just the general warmth and the atmosphere, and every time you saw a puppet and The Christmas Carol you hadn't seen before, one especially made for the film, I got a sense of glee. It's like, oh, I haven't seen this one yet. Or, you know, just like how it fitted into the Jim Henson over of like that style of puppetry, or, you know, but it just looked new and it was just really exciting for me. And yeah, I enjoyed it. It's not like a really highly ranked movie, but I watched it with my nieces and they were crying at first, like, I don't want to watch this. I want to watch Toy Story again. But it was just like, I was in charge and I made them watch it. And within about 5 minutes, they shut up and they were laughing at all the jokes. And, you know, like, they got into it and they just wanted to see more of Rizzo and Gonzo. And so did I. You know, it's just, it's a good film. It held their attention. And that's not something that often happens with them. They want to see what they want to see.
I'm with you on the narrators. I think they did a really good job with it. I loved the line when, I guess I've focused a lot on the kind of, you know, the horrible aspects of these films, and I love that they give a kind of throwaway line with Gonzo, and he's like, you know, should we be showing this to the kids? And he's like, it's okay, it's culture.
Aye, that's decent. I think they do run into problems with the narrators though, because sooner or later you realise that you're not truly invested in what Scrooge is up to. It's more about a story that's being told by Gonzo and Rizzo, and they're wise when the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come turns up to say, like, right, we're out of here, now you're with Scrooge, and it lets you, you know, build up to the point where you want to see his emotional transformation, whereas up until then, there's at least a kind of distance between you and Scrooge, because these guys are your focal point, these two. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I do like what they're doing. I think it's novel, and I think it keeps the story quite busy, because they can always jump in and give you a wee 1-2 or something or another.
Yeah. I mean, I think the oddest version that I saw was this one that was narrated by Vincent Price. I mean, it only lasted for like 20-odd minutes or so.
Was that a sinister Vincent Price?
No, he was just there, like, you know, in a suit, sitting in an armchair, reading things in his Vincent Price voice while, you know, other people did the heavy lifting. But it was like they didn't, you know, have the will or the time to actually make even a TV program about it. It was just like, okay, let's hit this beat about A Christmas Carol, and there's this ghost, and then that ghost, and then this ghost, and yay, it's Christmas.
Yeah.
It was a very strange kind of non-event. And I only watched it just because it was instantly accessible. It was just there on Amazon, and I just clicked on. It was
in like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I wonder what it exists as. I mean, is it like a B movie or like something like that, or?
I don't even know the source of it. I can only imagine it would have been like some kind of like
first run matinee
small
thing.
Kind of TV yeah. special kind of thing. It had kind of horrific like sound effects. The ghosts sounded like terrifying when they're emerging and so on. But visually, it just looked kind of silly and slapdash. So I mean, it's really just like a footnote in this podcast. It was just a kind of oddity that happened across.
No, I mean, it sounds interesting. I mean, if it at least brings something different to the table, like, then it's worth watching, I would say. I mean, I think the Muppets, clearly, for all you can say about the film, they are doing a lot that you're not going to see in any other version of this story, whether or not it's, whether it's the narrators, whether it's the puppets, it's, you know, I mean, the ghosts are fairly consistent between all the versions that I've seen. I think So in Muppet Christmas Carol, it's a little girl ghost. It's the big, fat, beardy guy for the Ghost of Christmas Present, and the ubiquitous Grim Reaper as the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come. I think we can maybe discuss later which versions of the ghosts that we like the best, but I think they do a pretty good job with the Ghost of Christmas Present, at least, and I think he gets a really good song in the Muppet Christmas Carol. What do you think of the songs generally? Do you like the songs in it?
I can't really comment on that. I really dislike musicals in general, and I tend to tune out them. Even in like Disney films, I do like I tune out music very, very easily and quickly.
Like I said, my viewing experience was somewhat disrupted by having rambunctious, crazy toddler ruining the evening.
I think the songs are really good generally. I think some are better than others. I'm really not a fan of the Tiny Tim song in it. I think that's pretty poor. But I love... Do you know what I actually love in the film? There's any time the film kind of stumbles onto a kind of sincere emotional thing. Like, I love the very opening. See what it says? Like, dedicated to the memory of Jim Henson and something else. And it's just got those opening notes and then the camera moving through the rooftops in London. I absolutely love that. I absolutely love Kermit's song. I can't remember the name of it now, it escapes me. Is it like It's Only One More Sleep Till Christmas or something like that?
That sounds right, yeah.
It's a lovely song, and it ends with him like staring at the moon while the little homeless bunny thing shivers in the street. And it was very, very touching. And I think that's nice when they can balance that poignancy with, you know, the Muppets being so unlikely to deal with that kind of material, that I think the film's at its best. But I think you're right in a sense, Jack. I think the highlights are with the puppets and not necessarily with Michael Caine.
Yeah, well, like I say, I enjoyed it in either case. I don't want to put it in a downer, because I did watch it with my nieces and they enjoyed it. And that's kind of time I get with them.
Yeah, there's a very pleasant cosiness for it, I think, for kids.
That's like, a really good way to put it. It is very true. It's very cosy. Yeah.
I know. I remember watching it at, like, primary school when they would have, you know, that taking the piss day where you just don't do any work and people bring in videos and stuff.
Oh, yeah, but you get to see the big TV on the car and you knew you were in for a good day. Yeah.
And I'll only ever associate it with the BFG and A Muppet Christmas Carol. but both are very poignant to kids when they see them. I don't know, something about the visuals of it and the again, the tone and the cosiness kind of just latches onto your brain.
Earth was always like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a lot of Wizard of Oz too.
They'd wheel out in that big like raised TV in the trolley. Always.
I mean, I think they maybe only had one or two videos, but I mean, nowadays with DVD, they must have 100 to choose from. They probably get Netflix on the telly that they bring in, so they'll be laughing.
Now we got that. I think one Christmas we got Krull, and I was really happy about that. to watch Krull. Yeah, they let us watch it at school.
In primary school?
Yeah, yeah.
Fucking hell.
It was like one of your primary teachers trying to be like, hey, I'm the cool teacher.
I don't even know, but I remember I'd never seen it, and the scene with the spider being like, oh my god, I'm just terrified. But yeah, they brought that in and let us watch it, but it was like, you know, towards later as a primary school, it wasn't like, you know, primary one, not trying to traumatize us. But yeah, I really enjoyed those days too. Like, they used to go into that one room of the school you didn't normally use and set up like loads of chairs. And for those not of this age range, it was a massive cathode ray TV on a trolley that made this really strange noise when you moved it. And you're constantly scared it was going to tip over because the cathode ray TV was like so precarious and so oversized for the trolley. But yeah, it was a big treat. I really enjoyed those days too. What else? Yeah, I saw young Sherlock Holmes at school too. And I'm like, there's a scene in that which is terrifying, but several scenes.
Oh, the cakes.
Yeah, I mentioned that before.
Those cakes creep me out, man.
Yeah, I mentioned that in like the podcast about the nothing things that's terrified this kid. There's this scene where basically young Sherlock Holmes is a very young, like, you know, high school age Sherlock Holmes and a high school age Watson, which is actually, from what I remember, a good film. I maybe should rewatch it. But several genuinely scary scenes, one of them where they're hallucinating and a really overweight Watson is being force-fed by anthropomorphic cakes stuffing themselves into his mouth. And it's done through puppetry, and it's really creepy, effectively creepy and scary.
Yeah, okay. I'll give that a shot.
It's worth seeing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, just given the title, it's not something that I would, you know, rush out to see. It sounds quite non-essential, but I mean, I'll give it a go. I'd happily give it a go.
It's got some good scenes.
I mean, as far as like the other Christmas Carol things that we've watched, what else do you feel is like worthy of mention just now?
Well, for me, the only one I have left is Scrooged. So, I mean, I'm passing over to you guys now. I'd quite like to talk about the story more generally after we're done talking about the films that we watched specifically. I mean,
from my side, the only other thing that stands out worth talking about was An American Christmas Carol. Jack, do you have anything?
No, honestly, like, I mean, just saying, like I was saying before the podcast recorded, that Scrooge was the first film I watched in 2 weeks. I watched it last night, so I watched the two films I talked about and that is all I've watched for the last 2 weeks. It's been hectic. But I mean, tell me about An American Christmas Carol.
It's not something I'd be like, you know, saying rush out and get it on, you know, on DVD or, you know, instantly, that kind of thing. It was just something that it recorded on the TiVo because I set a search for A Christmas Carol, and it, you know, and I think no. I did that, but because it was An American Christmas Carol, it didn't record. But Lauren thought, oh, Christmas Carol. So the wife recorded it for me. Aww. It's just a really comfy film. It's got Henry Winkler as Benedict Slade. So they've slightly tweaked the names. You know, Bob Cratchit is called Thatcher and stuff. It's set, I'd say you're looking kind of like you're looking at First World War times, because they're definitely, they have like, you know, events selling war bonds and stuff like that in it.
So the Depression.
It really luxuriates in the backstory of the Scrooge character, Benedict Slade. The film goes on for about 2 hours or so, documenting like his past in an orphanage and how he wants to, like, you know, build up the business of the guy who saved him from the orphanage, but how he's, you know, deeply frustrated because he won't, you know, listen to his ideas and go for the future and, you know, bring in things like mass production and, you know, taking, like, you know, monthly payments and all that kind of thing. It's like, it goes in this, like, whole, like, birth of industrialized America kind of vibe. it's not like a really visually ambitious film, but I was really comfy watching it. It was a kind of ideal TV Christmas movie.
But it's a film. It's a feature film, yeah.
I think it was a TV movie.
Oh, is it?
There's not been a huge amount of money spent on it by any means, but it's no worse for that. But yeah, it was nice to have a different side of things. It's the ghosts are more humanized. It doesn't go in for real horror. It's, you know, the Ghost of Christmas Past is, you know, they're all people who he's, you know, he's come across, you know, in his life. For him, the Ghost of Christmas Future is a black guy wearing a medallion.
yeah.
Who's like, you know, going to lead him to sort of, you know, a promised land of racial equality and stuff. But yeah, if you happen across it at some point in the next like 20 years at Christmas and you don't have anything to do, I'd give it some time. I was, you know, pleasantly surprised by it.
I'll keep an eye out. Yeah.
Try to think if there's anyone actually notable involved in making it. Because I didn't see
Henry Winkler is notable enough.
Huh?
Henry Winkler?
Henry Winkler is notable enough. But yeah, I mean, he does well because it's... I mean, it was only 1979 that it was made, so he does a good old man. And he does a, you know, a good kind of like, I'm a sort of up and coming, you know, young upstart who wants to, you know, forge his way in the business world and, you know, leave the woman he loves behind and then, you know, regret it forever and ever and ever. But yeah, he does a very good, like, kind of lonely old man who, you know, he's not, this character isn't as, like, kind of cold, kind of evil hearted as you get some of the Scrooges made out to be. It does kind of put him more of a kind of victim of circumstance, you know, shows him at an orphanage and that kind of thing, the kind of life that he had as a child, you know, making him just like, I want to be a somebody and not a nobody, and how that kind of turned him into someone he didn't want to be. But yeah, it was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, it sounds like a nice curiosity, but I think the risk with any of these is that they just get lost in a crowd of Christmas Carol films.
Yeah, I mean, there's hundreds of them, you know.
Yeah. So are we ready to talk about Scrooged then?
Yeah. I mean, is it all kind of consensus that this is the last thing we're talking about because it's the thing we enjoyed the most?
I would certainly say
so. Yeah, wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I'd say so too. This is a film that I had on VHS as maybe like a 12-year-old to a 15-year-old, and I completely ruined it just from watching it so much, and it's the first time I've seen it in maybe a very long time. I wouldn't want to say a very long time, and really very, very pleased about how well it held up. Pacing issues at one point, but other than that, very, very happy. I'm not really sure where... Okay, well, in case you haven't seen Scrooged, it's basically recontextualizing A Christmas Carol to what was then a contemporary 1980s America, where Scrooge is a television executive planning a live version of A Christmas Carol for viewing on Christmas Day. So it's a universe in which A Christmas Carol exists and someone is going through those same experiences of being revisited by his old boss to warn him, and then three spirits, and juggles the meta element really, really well. Very happy and having watched that. I don't want to say too much at this point because, once again, if I like it too much, I will just gush. So, what were your experiences? When's the last time you saw this?
I actually saw it last year and didn't have such a positive experience with it, which made me a little concerned revisiting it this year. I think my initial concerns were actually still there when I started watching it, because, I mean, as much as I don't like to, sometimes I can have a kind of structural focus when I watch films, and I feel like, oh, this has pacing issues, this should feel a little more natural than it does. But I think, see, once you learn in Scrooged to just be in the moment, then it's incredible. Like, each scene as it plays out in its isolation is just so wonderful, and there's always something to look forward to. with every scene that passes. There, I would totally agree that there are pacing issues, particularly in the early stages, but I don't think that's exclusive to just this version of A Christmas Carol, like you said, Martin. But, you know, I have absolutely no complaints by the time the end comes. I don't think it's a flawless film, but it's no doubt for me a 5-star film. I love it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think with the slow start of this movie, the main thing that jars is that as an actor, Bill Murray's just got so much positive regard for him as an actor and whatever character he is. Having him just be an arsehole is really difficult, because you're so used to him being a lovable arsehole and a sarcastic arsehole and an underdog arsehole. Having him being like the top dog arsehole of arseholes is just like, no, you're...
He does play CD really well, though. Like, he's got a great CD look in this film. Like, he looks disgraceful.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a fair amount of, you know, sleaze that comes his way, and he's perfectly happy with it, and, you know, that's okay. Yeah. But, yeah, I think once it gets, you know, full-blown into, you know, his old boss coming back as the, you know, the ghost of, you know, the Marley kind of character. I like the body horror in that.
Yeah.
The mouse crawling out the skull. That, I mean, it's a real nightmare kind of notion of, like, you know, falling to your doom with, like, you know, a corpse's arm that you've just, like, torn up.
Yeah, it's pretty morbid.
That scared me as a kid.
Pretty good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this as a kid as well, like, very, very young kid, and I remember it in the abstract quite a lot of the time. Like, I remember the look of that taxi driver in the taxi, and I remember the feeling in the office and stuff like that. So I always had, like, a high standard to live up to. Last year it didn't, this year it did. And I'm hoping from now on it will continue to live up to that high standard now that I know how to allow myself to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. But I think the failing was with you and not with the film.
Consistently.
Yeah. That's a theme we've explored regularly in
absolutely.
This show.
but yeah, now that I've got the key that allows me to enjoy the film, I couldn't be happier. I think with Bill Murray's performance in it, I do agree that there's just something slightly off at the beginning that I couldn't quite place what it was. I think he plays it as though his meanness is a really exaggerated performance, from the character's perspective as well as, you know, his own. So, like, when he indulges in his meanness, he's really over the top with it, as if he's putting it on, or as if there's some part of him that isn't quite fully embracing the meanness of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really clever. I mean, every Scrooged, like, almost immediately, there's never a moment where when they're taken back by the spirits that they are still in their old frame of mind when they're looking at the past. They know immediately that they've made mistakes, and they know immediately that what they're seeing now is something that they regret, and it's quite painful. But I think he wears that more than most other Scrooges that I've seen in his exaggerated badness. And I think it actually balances out at the end when what I think he portrays is like a really exaggerated goodness, where you feel like he isn't fully embracing this, that maybe the truth is somewhere a little bit pulled back from that. Even though I do believe in the sincerity of his motives at the end, I don't necessarily believe in every word he's saying that he's going to live Christmas, like, you know, every day from now on and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I do believe that because he, at the beginning, shows a propensity for exaggerated behaviour where there is still a kernel of truth to it, I think the truth at the end is somewhat pulled back from it. And I really do love his performance, if not only for that reason, but I think that adds a really cool layer to Scrooge.
Okay, I was saying that I didn't really buy the transformation of Bill Murray as Scrooge from the scenes in Ghost of Christmas Past into this nice guy who was overworking during Christmas party, into this corporate hungry guy who wanted so badly to be go up the chain, he was willing to be Frisbee the dog and ignore his best friends in Christmas. I didn't think there was enough substance in between those two scenes to make that a convincing transformation.
I don't know, I don't have a problem reading into it that something happened at some point that maybe turned him into the person that he is without it necessarily being the biggest, like, life lesson for him to learn. That, yeah, like, I these mean, were the lessons that he had to learn.
For me, I just took it as, like, the first step down a slippery slope kind of thing, yeah, rather than, you know, fleshing out the entire backstory of why he's this, like, you know, jaded, miserable shit.
Yeah. I mean, I would have felt that way too, but just that whole scene ends on, like, you know, let's have a trial separation and then a door closing on her face, Claire's face, as they leave. And I think that's a pretty definitive, you know, end to what they had. So I thought that scene tried to do too much and it affected. That stopped it from being a 5-star film for me, that scene there. As much as I thought it was good, it just tried to do too much. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I mean, I don't have a problem with it. Like,
yeah.
I think she does some really good work in it. And what's her name again? She's from Indiana Jones.
You know what? I was confused. I thought she was from Superman. I thought it was Lois Lane. And then my wife had to correct me. Like,
no.
It's Indiana Jones's bird.
Yeah. She does some... See, their relationship, I don't think I've seen a better version of, you know, the past relationship that he's lost, the Scrooge character.
Yeah.
Than Scrooged. I think they invest that in something very authentic, and it's really quite lovely, in the scenes that they have together.
Okay, I'd agree with that too. I think it's really sweet. But you don't often get to see Bill Murray being that sweet. It was really nice. Just the kind of range you can have. He's one of these actors, like, I'm not sure if he's typecast, or he just really enjoys playing pieces of shit, you know?
Yeah. I think it's maybe a bit of both. I think he likes the sort of sinister aspects of a lot of his characters, or at least those are the sort of dead-eyed dryness that he likes to play. But yeah, I mean, I think this character works absolutely perfectly for him. I think the ghosts are really good too. I think the Ghost of Christmas Past in this is probably the best Ghost of Christmas Past of any version that I've seen as well. I think that taxi driver character is just so distinctive and definitive and attached to this film. Like I say, there's no better for me.
Yeah, I was watching that thinking it was Benicio Del Toro for the first 10 minutes. Like, it's gotta be Benicio Del Toro. It's like, I checked out my IMDb afterwards, like, no, you're just being kind of racist, Mr. McFarlane. That was a person of a certain background in New York. Like, so that's not the case. But I agree with you, he's really good. He's not my favourite Ghost of Christmas Past. That was from The Muppets Christmas Carol with that,
Really? The little girl?
Yeah, I just thought it was really beautiful. I mean, I enjoyed that character a lot more, but I thought that, in fact, I don't even know. I'm going to recant that. I'm not sure. I really enjoyed the female puppet from, A Muppet's Christmas Carol. I thought it was really beautifully done. The effects on it, the voice acting on it, just the way it looked and acted and interacted with Scrooge, I thought it was really beautiful. And that's not something you expect to see about the Muppets at any point. Like, it was beautiful, but it was gorgeous. It was so sweet and sincere and lovely. And then you get the ghost from Christmas Past and Scrooge was just this horrible, horrible man who's probably a lot of fun to be around, you know, at the same time. And I liked his twisted sense of humour, and his sort of, like, anarchism to what he was doing and just freewheeling around life. I loved the flashback to his childhood, to Bill Murray's Scrooge's childhood, and his dad bringing him home veal as a Christmas present. I thought that was...
It's good.
Yeah.
It's really good. And as I say, I always love in these films where he does go back to the past and he's immediately heartbroken. Like, it's not as if he's ever, you know, defiant, or I mean, he can be defiant in some moments, but his general mood is one of, you know, like, I'm aware that this was horrible and that it has led me down a dark path. And rarely do they ever leave the individual scenes feeling as if they are completely, you know, righteous in the way that they've lived their life. I like those scenes. I really like the scenes in Ghost of Christmas Present too. Maybe I just haven't quite come round to The Ghost of Christmas Present and Scrooged, which maybe doesn't quite do it for me, the constant kicking of the balls and stuff. But I do like the scenes that she invites him to. I like the scenes with Tiny Tim and all that, or the Tiny Tim equivalent. I just, yeah, I mean, my experience with it was profoundly positive. The week, I think it would be hard not to say that it starts to get a bit rushed at the end, and certainly the Ghost of Christmas, as soon as the Ghost of Christmas Future turns up, he plays out two strange scenes, one where Tiny Tim's locked up in an asylum, and one where
Claire
has become some kind of socialite who hates the poor. Truly bizarre, but...
Yeah, I mean, she's gone into kind of Cruella de Vil kind of mode.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite stimulating in a sort of 80s... Like, it feels very 80s. It feels like something from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey or something like that. I like them for what they are, but they're possibly not, you know, the strongest stepping stones to a resolution. And then the film just gets overwhelmed by the spirit of Christmas, it would seem, and just draws itself to a conclusion with a massive speech and grandiose gestures. But I do really like that. I like that visceral feeling of the film itself even being overcome by the spirit of Christmas.
Robert Mitchum's having fun. Yeah. It's Christmas.
Like, that kind of appeals to me as someone who's a massive Christmas fan, unlike, you know, certain other people in this room and in Los Angeles. So yeah, I do really like that conclusion, even though, you know, it's somewhat unconvincing. It's still a big pleasure.
Do you feel it's unconvincing?
Sorry?
Do you feel it's unconvincing?
It's not. I think it's just because the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come sequence is so short, and, you know, so abstract, that by the time he comes out of it, I don't know that I'm necessarily convinced that he's completely changed in the way that he's stressing that he's changed. But then again, I can adjust that by the fact that I think the character himself is overstating, because he has a history of overstating. So for me, it comes down to the performance again, and I do buy in that moment that he is legitimately saying the things that he says, even if he doesn't believe them himself. But he believes a version of them, but just not quite to the extent that he's stressing them. He's stressing them for effect.
I got a lot out of the Ghost of Christmas Future, because it was, aside from the 1951 version we were talking about first, which had a really simple plain Grim Reaper, which was really effective, I really liked the Ghost of Christmas Future from Scrooge. They played it for comedic effect when it pulled open the cloak, you know, like the guy's screaming inside the ribcage, sort of like a Hellraiser or a Freddy Krueger type special effect, but played for laughs. But the idea that this face is like a television screen and just like overlaying flickering images and things like that, I found very effective. I know what you're talking about in terms of the future it presented to him. It was like German expressionism in some scenes, but it didn't affect, like, you know, it's just, that's just, your future can be horrific. Your future can be horrific in every way that alters reality around it. Like, just, you know, these two words you gave to this woman because you were frustrated by her giving her time to the poor rather than to you has completely changed her worldview. You've changed everything you loved about her. And the speech at the end that Bill Murray gives about, you know, every day can be Christmas and you get greedy for it and things like that. Honestly, I completely bought that. Every time I see it, and this is like very saccharine, I get a little lump in my throat. When I was a kid, I used to cry at that scene. I'd be embarrassed by it. But even now, watching it last night, it got a lump in my throat. Yeah. It meant something to me.
I both had a gulp when Tiny Tim does his little bit, or the Tiny Tim equivalent, and when we both just died laughing at each other. Because it was so blatant that both of us at the very same time got teared up. And Emma never cries at anything in films, and I'm always a big Wayne. But the fact that we both did it at the same time was unique, if nothing else.
Well, to me, and monologues and movies about people bursting onto TV sets, Peter Finch and Network is at one end of the spectrum, and Bill Murray and Scrooge is at the other. But to me, that is just as good as I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I think it's a wonderful scene, and it's not something you couldn't pitch Bill Murray doing that and being convincing based on anything about his acting career before that. You couldn't. There's nothing to base that on, that he could pull off that level of just, you know, intense joy and revelation. But he does it.
I don't know. I mean, there's something in it that seems like kind of manic and scary to me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I think it's too much to a certain extent, but again, it's too much in a way that I think is intentional.
Oh, yeah.
Where you think the truth is maybe just a little bit removed from that, but not entirely. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he does believe what he's saying. He just isn't going to exactly live out the way that he says he's going to live it out. One thing I do like in the film as well, that's part of Bill Murray's performance, is the way that he immediately goes back to the way that he was as soon as he's out of reach of the ghosts. Do you know what I mean? Like, as soon as he snaps back to reality, he's like, right, I can forget the lessons that I've just learned there, even though the lessons themselves, whether or not he believes that these visitations actually happened, he should be learning the lessons as he goes, but instead he decides that, you know, he's out of earshot of whoever it is that wants him to change, so he can just be the biggest dick again that he wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think I like the fact that they give him some breathing space between the ghosts, whereas in Christmas Carol it tends to be he, you know, sees the ghost of Christmas past, he goes back to his house and, you know, he's still in bed, then the next ghost comes, he's, you know, then he immediately sees the third.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's at least time to show that he's really going to be a tough cookie to crack, or a tough nut to crack, I should say, because he's, whenever he's not immediately held to account, he's going to be a dick again.
Mm. That's a very good point. I liked the amount of breathing space I had, and I liked a lot of the stuff that I built into it. Was it the homeless guy, Henry, who dies in the basement?
Yeah, that was interesting. That's a new touch. I know that the Scrooge, the Alistair Sim version, rather, tried to shoehorn quite a lot of stuff in about the poor that I wasn't entirely convinced by. But I do like the way that Scrooge handles the kind of the needy of the world aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I just got it. I think it's a movie with a lot of heart and a really good sense of humour, and those are not things easily married. And
I mean, what I was thinking as well about Richard Donner, the director, and how I really don't like him as a director, but I like a lot of the films that he makes. I love Scrooged, I like Lethal Weapon, I like The Omen, I like Superman, I prefer Richard Lester, but he's a guy without any personality, it seems, but I consistently like his films, but I feel like, to a certain extent, I do like him, because I do like what he's doing to these films, but I could never say I'm a Richard Donner fan. I think that's not a statement anyone could stand behind.
I was looking him up on Letterboxd after that, just trying to think, like, what has he done? You know, I know he's a director, I know films he's done. I know the 25 films he's made, I think I've seen about half of them, and that really did surprise me. So I'd probably say the same thing, is like, I would never go out of my way to see a Richard Donner movie, but at the same time, I've seen half of his films, you know, so what does that say, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't... I think with a lot of directors, you get a kind of personality cult that builds up around, you know, liking, you know, the public projection of this person, and you get a couple of movies that, you know, that satisfy, you know, the kind of artistic achievement that justifies, you know, worshipping this person. But no, I mean, I think he's a very competent filmmaker.
Yeah, I think he's a good workman. Like, he's a very.
I think it's really high praise to say you're a really competent filmmaker and you regularly make good films.
Yeah.
I think when you say he's a workman, then you're just like...
No, for sure. And I would be really selling it short because, like I say, there are images from the film that stuck with me all the way through childhood and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would be degrading them in a way that I think,
like Jack said, special effects stuff with, you know, the kind of the puppetry in the ribcage.
Yeah.
That's like, it's like comically ghoulish, but there's enough horror in that to be like, ooh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
agreed.
I think as far as like the fun aspects of the film, I really enjoyed Carol Kane as the Ghost of Christmas Present.
Yeah.
I thought she was a lot of fun. I think as a character, he deserved to be beaten up anyway, so I'm absolutely fine with it happening. It was done with great humour and panache. I thought the violence linked to the scenes really well, like, because he was always like, you know, crashing into another scene from this like random act of violence that she'd committed on him.
I like this. You're talking around to her. Yeah, she is cool. Uh-huh. I mean, if I could give it more than 5 stars, I would.
So I think that was the most like enjoyable aspect of the film for me, was their interaction and just, you know, the way she was able to boss that character around, and when he's so used to being, you know, the head honcho. Mm. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Actually, that's a really good point. Yeah, there's very few attempts to like manhandle him in the film, to actually physically put him where he needs to be, and I think that character does serve that function very well, to like be a literal slap in the face.
Yeah, yeah. Just from a completely perfunctory point of view, from getting him from, you know, one scene into, you know, a frozen basement where, you know, this character, the homeless guy that he's met in the shelter, has now died. You know, she's just like, I'll just hit him into it. It's fine. You know?
Yeah, very good. I mean, glad to hear that we all had such a good reaction to it.
Well, I think, I'm not sure. Okay, here's my thing. And it isn't even a consideration, but how well would this have worked without leaning on the lineage of other, you know, Christmas Carol adaptations? Mm. You know, it does, and those things do exist, so it doesn't have to exist in a vacuum. And I think that's in itself very clever. It's like doing a superhero movie without having to do an origin story. Like, everyone knows where Superman comes from. We don't have to do an origin story. We just lean on it. So this is acknowledging it by having a Scrooge within Scrooge, but not having to like get too prissy about it. Let's just take our own, let's just make it work for a contemporary audience, and, you know, let's put our own sense of humour into it. And I really appreciated that. You know, I thought that was very clever.
Yeah, I mean, for as much as it doesn't maybe feel as insular as it could, and that's no fault to the film, I think, like we say, the Christmas Carol is so ubiquitous now that it's almost part of just the world generally that's there to be adopted. But I think the film does feel singular. Like, it's hard to think of a film that has the same feeling that Scrooge does. So yeah, I think it more than compensates for a perceived lack of originality. Bless you.
You were a baby, or you?
That was Kiyomi.
That was neither. That was my wife, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. She's making a cup of tea, I think. it's something very glad to have re-seen again, and I've done this recently where you go back and see something you really enjoyed as a kid, and there's just that fear, like, I'm not going to like this, and I'm really glad it didn't let me down. I'm just really, really happy that I got, you know, as much, maybe even more out of it this time around. Yeah, it's just a really nice experience. You were talking about The Ghost of Christmas Present. It's just such a radical left turn from every other version of it. Like, the one that we watched with Alistair Sim was just a sort of pimped out, somewhat Santa guy with loads of gold chains and a beard.
Yeah. Same with Muppet Christmas Carol. He's consistently a jolly fat, you know, guy with a beard.
Uh-huh. I mean, the Robert Zemeckis version, you're looking at a very similar look to the Muppet Christmas Carol, except kind of beefier and, I don't know, he's a bit more porny.
Okay. But I think, from my experience, he tends to be the most consistent, the Ghost of Christmas Present. The most changeable tends to be the Ghost of Christmas Past. Mm. Oh no, in fact, I was going to say, like, the absolute most consistent is the Ghost of Christmas Future, but Ghost of Christmas Past.
Yeah, they're just the kind of genetic, you know, horror apparition kind of thing.
But Past, it's almost like a roll of the dice, you know, exactly what's going to turn up, and it's rare to see two versions that are exactly alike. But my favourite is the Scrooge version.
Mm. I mean, from my notion of if they made Scrooge now, I don't think he'd be a TV producer. I think he'd be making films.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was like the kind of, you know, it used to be like advertising executives in films. Like, that's the way to show that the person has no soul and needs to be saved. In the 80s, TV was fair game. But now I think Hollywood's so, like, you know, bankrupt.
Yeah.
And, like, desperately scratching for ideas.
Like a kind of fringe thing.
Everyone loves TV, you know, series is, you know, so much more passionately just now than they do, like, you know, current filmmaking. But I think, yeah, it'd be like kind of a flip-flop scenario. I
can see that.
Yeah.
I was hoping we, like, just talk generally about the story itself, like A Christmas Carol. I was going to ask you guys, like, do you think, just, like, no specific example in mind, do you think you're supposed to relate to Ebenezer Scrooge, or do you think you're supposed to look at him as a bad example immediately? In terms of a character,
I think you might look at my bad example immediately. I mean, he comes in. Well, you're not really given anything to empathize with. He's horrible. He hates Christmas. You know, he hates people. Someone's like due to give him debt. He won't give his employee a day off, or if he does, he does it at a twist of an arm. You know, he lets him, you know, freeze inside his office. He's mean to everyone. He has no friends. So no, I don't think he's anything but a bad person. But he's built up in such a way where the antagonist is central to the plot. And then you see him go through things where you start to, you know, have some sympathy towards him through the various flashbacks in Christmas past.
Hmm.
Well, what's your opinion on it?
I feel like every time I watch a version of A Christmas Carol, I feel like it's a warning directly to me about what would happen if I lived exactly the way that my instincts tell me to live. Like, I would end up like this guy,
uh-huh.
A miserable, miserly, lonely old bastard. Which is, you know, something that probably just speaks to my own anxieties. But I think you're supposed to, obviously, there's an aspect of Scrooge that's like a caricature where you're supposed to view him as like the extreme of,
I think,
of problems that you might have in your own
it's
life.
Like, look what the world did to this person to make this person exist.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a monster, but he's a monster that's been created out of, you know, sort of pain and neglect. So,
yeah,
you know, they're kind of indivisible.
I can see that. I think we're all supposed to learn the lessons that Scrooge learns, but I think Scrooge is obviously at the extremes of, you know, anything we could experience in our own life. But we all are tighter with money than we could be, like in terms of we all live lives of, you know, excess to some extent, while some people, you know, die from poverty.
I mean, it's the hardest thing to do in anyone's life is to, you know, I mean, not being bad to people can be fairly straightforward, but, you know, actively doing some good,
yeah,
that's the horrible bit. That's the hard bit.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. So I think we're supposed to learn a lesson from Scrooge, even if we're not supposed to immediately identify with Scrooge, although I do. And Emma would say that I'm more like Scrooge than even I worry that I am.
No, you've got Christmas presents here, and I don't have any Christmas presents for you, so I wouldn't worry about it.
Well, you talk about if you lived your life to your complete instincts, you'd live like Scrooge. If I had lived my life to my, like, just instincts, base instincts, I would have died at 25. So I don't know how much I can learn from Scrooge.
You might not have died. It might just be like, you know, homeless and scary.
Yeah. I make one of those guys freezing to death that Scrooge has to go and then help.
You remember the Neon Raver guy who's like, you know, go about on the buses in Glasgow? You might have just been him.
Oh, God. Oh, that's a terrifying thought. Oh, I don't want to think about that.
Imagine that was like a Ghost of Christmas Future vision.
I can totally see that working. Strange man.
Yeah.
Well,
sorry, Jack. Are you busy or
you? No. I'm fine. I was just when you talk about him being identifiable as like a warning, I understand what you mean. But do you think this is basically a morality tale? Is that what you're saying?
I think it is to some extent. I think it's supposed to. I mean, it's very intentional about talking about the poor in most versions. I think the poor is, I mean, obviously that's the theme of the film, for someone who's rich to have to give up his money in service of others. I mean, it's got obviously very Christian themes. There's lessons to be learned about, you know, the way that you treat other people and stuff like that. I think is at its core a morality tale, but, you know, obviously it's a character, like I say, that's played at extremes. So there's a distance there, but I think we'd all be wise to watch the film and take something away from it in terms of trying to be better people generally. One thing that I did pick up on that I was curious about is the way that it's something I've certainly noticed in my own life, that it's very easy. Like, I watch these films and I think about Scrooge and his relationship with Tiny Tim and stuff like that, and I'm not convinced that if Scrooge was literally in Bob Cratchit's house talking to him and his wife and Tiny Tim, that he would walk away with the same, you know, concern about the kid's future. It's the fact that Scrooge can be there and not be seen that just invests him fully in their lives, where he can actually see the world from their perspective because he doesn't have to actively contribute to it. And it's the same way you can watch a film or a television program and be motivated to do something more so than you would be if you were actually in the situation itself. It's a curious thing. I mean, Roger Ebert talks about cinema as like a machine for producing empathy. And I feel like that's a similar idea when Scrooge visits these places without being seen, that he's able to indulge in a cinematic type empathy just by watching these characters live their life without having to actively contribute to it himself. I don't know, would you agree with that idea?
Well, it's the first time I've heard it, but it's very eloquent.
Distance and, I think you put it very well.
Oh, thank you.
I don't think you need me to expand on.
I think it's. Oh, go on.
No, I just feel like I'm obliged to disagree with you because of our on-air relationship, but I've got nothing to say. It's very eloquently put. I didn't realize it was Roger Ebert that said that, though. I thought it was the Irish film critic. Damn it. Oh, whatever. But it was Roger Ebert who said that.
I believe so. I might be wrong, but assured that it is from someone.
It's a beautiful thing to say. I agree completely that the cinema is this empathy machine, and it does great things to people. I mean, you said yourself that you cry all the time at cinema, but you put yourself in a situation to allow yourself to feel empathy, to try and increase your worldview, to see things in a different way, and that's definitely something I'm looking for storytelling in general. But traditionally, I've veered towards cinema because, frankly, it does it best. I mean, not in all cases. I mean, I don't want to get into a broad comparison between different modes of storytelling, but cinema's very, very good at it. And one of these things that's always been my hobby, I think.
Absolutely. And I think, would that be a nice place to wrap up?
Yeah, I've said my piece. Yeah.
Likewise.
Yeah, said my piece. Well, cool. Merry Christmas, guys. Until next
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. It's been a pleasure.
Is this the outro?
Are we? I thought we were.
Jack, you were
wrapping it up.
Yeah, but Jack hasn't said his bit. What's his bit again?
I don't know.
How do we not know how to do this after a year?
It's been a few weeks and.
Yeah, it has been a few weeks.
Jack's half dead, I'm half dead.
You said until next time. So you need to say that, or else...
Yeah, Jack threw the whole thing by saying Merry Christmas.
Yeah, you need to say...
A free-for-all.
Say it, at least in some way, shape, or form, you need to say, until next time.
Okay, so try and say it again.
Until next year.
Yeah, go again.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Until next...
Merry Christmas, guys. Until next time. Until next year.
It feels weird if he says Merry Christmas and none of us say Merry Christmas as well. Yeah.
Okay, he'll say Merry Christmas. We will say Merry Christmas. And then he can say until next time. Agreed?
I think you should just broadcast this as it is.
Okay.
Podcasting's not easy sometimes.
Right, have a good Christmas, guys. See you later.
Okay, like, you want to do it? Okay, I'll try genuinely. You want me to say Merry Christmas, then what do you want me to say?
I will insist.
If you say Merry Christmas, guys, then we'll say Merry Christmas, and you can say until next time, and
then we can feel like we've closed off the show.
Okay, cool.
Okay, right. Okay. Well, Merry Christmas, guys.
Merry Christmas.
Don't ruin this, Jack. Come on. I'm counting
until
on
next
you.
Time.
It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Film Interrupted. If you want to contact us, we can be reached at Film Interrupted on Gmail, Tumblr, Facebook, and of course iTunes. If you'd like to contact us on Letterboxd, I can be found under TechnoSnob303, Martin under Martino Heat, and Nick under Nick Ede. Nice handle, Nick.